From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
It's the stupidest thing I ever did. It's an illusion. And look what I have to do. I'm sitting here by a stupid mistake.
Say it isn't so, Mac Man. I mean, say it is so, because we kind of knew it all along. Ahead on Only a Game, Mark McGuire swings for the fences with a long, long overdue confession. Also ahead, a small Indonesian village attempts to revive its economy with a rebuilt golf course and a history of American Olympic basketball, including the triumphs, the failures, the international intrigue, and even hardy souls attempting the bounce pass on muddy, rain-soaked courts. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week's NFL playoff action features the teams that won last week and the teams that performed so well during the regular season that they didn't even have to play last week. Will the latter all be so rusty that they don't remember what to do when the quarterback shouts, "Stunt right, 48, gravel train, oatmeal, Monday, Monday"? Joining me now to answer that and various other playoff-related questions is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Oatmeal.
Yeah. You know what to do?
Well, I'm not schooled in it's why I'm not a player. I do know what to do with oatmeal, though.
Today's first game pits the New Orleans Saints against the Arizona Cardinals. Each of these teams has had rather dramatic ups and downs throughout the season. Does this mean that anything could happen in today's tilt in New Orleans?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Saints were the hottest team in football for the first 13 weeks of the season, but they're coming into the playoffs on a three-game losing streak. So a very unusual situation. Arizona is a team that last year, terrible end of the regular season, and then came really within one great grab by the Steelers, Santonio Holmes, of winning the Super Bowl. This is a playoff club, and you saw it on Sunday. Kurt Warner played a near-perfect football game last week, and if he's going to play like that and the Cardinals are going to put up 50 points, it's just pretty simple math, but it's very difficult to beat a team in the 50s. So a lot of pressure on the New Orleans defense and the New Orleans offense. This is going to be a very exciting game. I think New Orleans would have to be favored because they're playing at home and they probably have the better team. But we've seen Kurt Warner do this before, so it's going to be a toss-up.
Much has been made of what it would mean for New Orleans to have a winning team, and maybe that's a bit melodramatic/misguided considering the problems that residents of the city still face. But heavens, a Saints Super Bowl appearance would be pretty great, wouldn't it?
You know, it would. I think it is overblown, all of this stuff, because no matter who wins, your house doesn't get rebuilt, the insurance claim doesn't get filed, or the school that you went to, your kids went to, doesn't, you know, just return to pure functionality. But there is something about, particularly an NFL team, that lifts the collective spirits of a city. I mean, nothing really rallies people in America like an NFL team. It means a lot to the people in New Orleans. The Saints have always been their team. You don't want to make too much of it because it doesn't solve big problems, but it solves maybe a little one.
Tonight, the Baltimore Ravens are in Indy to face the formerly Baltimorean Indianapolis Colts. Do the Ravens stand a chance against Peyton Manning and friends, or was their destruction of the New England Patriots last weekend a fluke?
Baltimore is the one team in this playoffs that isn't quarterback-based or offense-based. The Jets are a little bit like this. If you look at the storylines of this playoff, you're going to talk about Drew Brees and Brett Favre and Peyton Manning and Kurt Warner and all these quarterbacks. No one's talking about Flacco with the Ravens. They're talking about Ray Lewis, Ed Reed, this defense that will pound you. This is old-school football. They talk in the locker room about saying, hey, the one thing we can control in this game is we're going to be tougher than the other team. I mean, it's old 1940s blood and gut stuff. If they can shut down Peyton Manning, if they can force him into the mistakes that they did with Tom Brady last week, three interceptions and a fumble loss, yeah, they got a chance, but that is a tall order.
Tomorrow, the Dallas Cowboys are in Minnesota to play the Vikings. Do we dub that one the game of the week?
Well, I think that it's come into that. I mean, everyone wants to know what Brett Favre is going to do. He was brought into Minnesota to lead them to a Super Bowl. The Vikings were a playoff team a year ago without him. And so all the fun that he had this season, all the drama, all the up and down, this is when it pays off. He's at home, but he's got to go against what's probably the hottest team in football in the Cowboys, who have absolutely since mid-December hit another gear. They're playing like the Giants did a couple years ago when they came out of nowhere to win the Super Bowl. Cowboys have got everything going. And I think actually the key to this is Favre doesn't make mistakes. Tony Romo makes mistakes or doesn't, the Dallas Cowboy quarterback. But also, I actually think this game is going to be won based on how well the Vikings could run the ball. If it's all about Brett Favre, I don't like Minnesota's chances.
Brett Favre's former team, or one of them anyway, the Green Bay Packers, are out of the playoffs, courtesy of the Arizona Cardinals, but not before taking part in the highest-scoring NFL playoff game of all time. How come you didn't email me last week and say that was the game I should have watched?
It was awesome. Who knew? You know, in the second half, no one could stop anybody. Aaron Rodgers, who is Brett's successor and the one that the Packers chose instead of him, kind of showed that he's the guy for the future. And I think even in a loss, gained tremendous amounts of fan support in Green Bay. And then Warner, before the game, all the rumors was if they lose, he's going to retire. Comes out and has 500-plus passing yards, five touchdowns. One of literally the greatest individual performances in the history of the NFL. And you say, where are you retiring to? You know, what are you, crazy?
Wouldn't it have been great if after that performance he'd said, I am retiring. I'm going out on top. You guys find somebody else for next week.
It might be. I mean, good Lord. You couldn't play better. It was a thrilling game, and it was helpful because a lot of dull games last week.
The last game of the weekend showcases the upstart New York Jets against the San Diego Chargers. Many feel the Chargers are the best team in the National Football League right now, but that team always seems to blow it in the playoffs. Do they avoid that this year?
Well, they're definitely the hottest team in the NFL. They have not lost since a one-point defeat in mid-October. At that point, they were 2-3 on the season, and they haven't lost since. Dominant offense, dominant defense. At this point, a lot of people are certainly picking San Diego. San Diego comes in red hot, but who knows? The Jets are a defensive team. They run the ball, control the clock. They have a tremendous secondary. They have a rookie quarterback who, at least last week, made no mistakes, managed the game very well, isn't trying to do too much. So there's a lot of things in the Jets' favor, too. I think as games go, you know, I think San Diego would rather have a team that tries to get in a shootout with them. The Jets aren't going to do that. The Jets can run their game plan. They every bit, they can come in there and beat them.
Dan Wetzel covers the NFL and lots of other stuff for Yahoo Sports, and he shares his wit and wisdom with us from time to time as well. Dan, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
On Monday, Mark McGwire, he of the 70 home runs in 1998, acknowledged that he had used steroids throughout much of his baseball career. Very shortly thereafter, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig announced that the so-called steroid era was a thing of the past. Among those who don't necessarily agree with Commissioner Selig, or who at least think his celebration is premature, is Dr. Gary Wadler, the chair of the Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee for the World Anti-Doping Agency. He maintains that baseball can never let down its guard when it comes to steroids and various other substances.
There were 108 people getting exemptions to take drugs for attention deficit disorder, which are basically stimulants, which clearly have an impact on performance in baseball. To have that many have attention deficit disorder boggles the mind.
Dr. Wadler's concern extends beyond the suspicion that ballplayers are getting themselves diagnosed with attention deficit disorder so they can legally use stimulants. He points out that Commissioner Selig's optimism fails to take into account another fairly common performance enhancer.
We still have to worry about human growth hormone. That's out there. The problem is that it requires a blood test for detection. Well, all the professional sports in the United States refuse to have blood tests.
The other problem with Commissioner Selig's happy assertion that the steroid era is a thing of the past becomes evident when one considers the present of two of Mark McGwire's most accomplished contemporaries, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, neither of whom is likely to be free of the tentacles of the judicial system for some time. And according to USA Today baseball writer Mel Antonin, neither is likely to follow McGwire's lead.
Right now, they're under investigation by the federal government, the Justice Department, for allegedly lying under oath Roger Clemens to the Congressional Committee and Barry Bonds to a grand jury investigating Belko in San Francisco. So if they came out now and said, you know, that we took steroids or I took steroids, the government would probably go after them.
When Mark McGuire appeared before a congressional committee almost 5 years ago, he said only that he was not there to talk about the past. This week, he claimed that he had wanted to come clean on that occasion, but that his lawyers had advised him not to do it without a promise of immunity from prosecution, which McGuire was not offered. Though McGuire was ridiculed for sidestepping questions about his steroid use on national television, he never committed perjury, which, according to Mel Antonin, will make his eventual acceptance more likely.
When people see that when you tell the truth, you know, the public in baseball gives you a second chance. It not only happened with Mark McGuire, it happened with Andy Pettit, who was mentioned in the Mitchell report. It happened with Jason Giambi, the New York Yankees first baseman who had an $80 million contract. And in a sense, it's happening with Alex Rodriguez, who just a year ago finally called a press conference and admitted it, and fans generally forgot about it.
If lots of fans have already forgotten, forgiven, or both, the same can't necessarily be said of some of the members of the Baseball Writers of America, who determine which players will enter the Hall of Fame. McGuire's progress toward induction has been non-existent. In the most recent balloting, 22% of the writers checked his name, and 75% is the minimum requirement for immortalization. At least one writer plans to continue to withhold his support from anybody who played during the enhanced days.
I would vote for no one.
Drew Sharp casts his Hall of Fame ballots from Detroit, where he's a columnist with the Free Press.
I will have an empty ballot if need be. If the Baseball Writers Association wants to take my ballot away because of that, so be it. I believe it's my responsibility to try to maintain the integrity of what baseball competition should be.
Sharp feels that steroids were so widespread during the so-called era of same that no player from that time can be trusted, at least until they provide confessions more complete than the one Mark McGuire offered on Monday.
They have to provide a blueprint, a roadmap, to let everyone know how deeply ingrained steroids were in baseball. If they can do that, then maybe it might be easier for everyone to accept it and come to some type of compromise as to how we're going to recognize the achievements of this era. I want to know names. I want to know facts. I want to know times and places. And until you have these players do that, we're never going to come to the end of the chapter of the steroids era.
Much as Commissioner Selig might like us to believe otherwise, Mr. Sharp may well have it right.
Well, the fans came from everywhere. With every swing, they stood and cheered. Baseball's number one. Mark and Sammy made that clear. And on one fateful day, September 8, 98, McGuire knocked out 60 teams. The crown was handed over. The record had been broken. All the fans, they cheered. McGuire was.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Traditionally, in celebration of Theophany, a Christian feast day in January, young men and not-so-young men in the Albanian town of Tirana dive into the Ionian Sea to retrieve a metal cross. This time around, tradition took a bit of a knock when the cross was retrieved by a 16-year-old Albanian girl. Of the victorious girl, Katerina Munguli, the organizer of the competition said it was a cold day and she competed with several boys and men. We were all happy a girl got the cross. Ms. Munguli is no doubt happy too, since the town council awarded her 10,000 lex, about $120. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, golf as an economic stimulus in Indonesia. But first, changing jobs and moving is stressful. It's even more stressful when your resignation inspires hundreds of people to protest, angers thousands more, and earns you a police escort when you leave the building. That was the reaction when University of Tennessee football coach Lane Kiffin stepped down on Tuesday in order to coach for the University of Southern California. Joining me now to discuss the impact of Kiffin's departure and the coach who will replace him is Austin Ward of the Knoxville News Sentinel. Austin, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Lane Kiffin was hired by Tennessee a little less than 14 months ago after he was fired by the Oakland Raiders of the National Football League. Was Kiffin's hiring well-received by fans in Tennessee at that time?
Well, I think, you know, when it first happened, there was a lot of questions, issues raised about his resume and what he could really do and how he became a candidate. But he won them over pretty quickly with just by generating some excitement. He did it by saying some pretty crazy things, but I think more importantly, he did it by putting together an excellent recruiting class in a brief period of time. Mm-hmm. And then from there, the 7-6 record maybe doesn't seem like he, you know, beat the world, and he didn't, but there was obviously a lot of room for him to grow. And that's why you see so many people who are upset with him leaving.
And the level of frustration was considerable. I saw this described as a riot in some places. Tell me what you saw.
I think that's maybe a bit of an exaggeration. I was out there in the middle of it. I think it was somewhere in between a rave and a riot. It was there was a burning mattress and you know, maybe some students who were drinking a little too much and some obscenities, and you know, Tennessee has a rock that's pretty famously decorated that had some, you know, not so very nice words on there directed at Lane and his family. Yeah. You know, the police were able to keep it under control. And some Tennessee football players were out there trying to spin some of the negativity into positive things about, you know, staying at Tennessee and being a volunteer and what that means. And rather than focusing on it, the people that were leaving tried to rally around, you know, what it means to actually still be at the school and what it still means to be, you know, a Tennessee football player.
Kiffin had been an assistant coach at USC, of course, and he said this week that coaching the Trojans was the only job that could have lured him away from Knoxville. Has that garnered him any sympathy back in Tennessee, or are people sort of taking that with a grain of salt?
I think they're taking it with a pretty big grain of salt. I mean, he has a way of, he's generally very open. Not everything that he says you can take on face value. Was that the only college job that he would have taken? probably. I mean, that's sort of the way he leaves himself wiggle room in situations like that. He did the same thing with the arrests and the hostesses and all the other issues. You have to be very careful because he's savvy enough to know what he's saying and to leave himself loopholes.
You mention the arrests, the hostesses, etc. Three freshman players were involved in a robbery under Lane Kiffin's watch. And in fact, there were six other secondary recruiting violations. Is he walking away from a mess?
You know, he's said publicly and repeatedly that he's leaving Tennessee in better shape than when he inherited them 14 months ago. There's a reason it could be worse. You look at the hostesses, well, that could possibly be a seventh violation. There was an incident with a recruiting intern that he took on the road. Maybe that could be eight. And I think that's why Tennessee's maybe had some problems this week. When it has interviewed candidates to replace Kiffin, there's always that looming over their head, and you don't want to walk into that situation.
When a college football coach leaves, the ripple effects on a team can last for years. New recruits may decide to sign with other programs, and future recruiting can be hurt when a team appears to be unstable. How much do you expect Lane Kiffin's departure to affect the Vols in the short run?
It might set them back one class that Lane Kiffin was recruiting. In fact, it almost certainly will. But the way that this schedule played out for Tennessee in 2010, they were most likely going to struggle anyway, whether he was the coach or not. So in some ways, this might be the best situation for them to have their hands clean and be able to start over and just sacrifice 2010. Now, the man who has been tabbed as his replacement at this moment, Derek Dooley from Louisiana Tech, no one's going to expect him to win 8 or 9 games at Tennessee next year because that wouldn't have been a reasonable expectation for Lane Kiffin.
I'm glad that you've brought the conversation out of the past, albeit the recent past, and into the future. Tell us a little bit about Derek Dooley and what we should look forward to as he takes over at Tennessee.
That's the $2 or $3 million question right now for Tennessee Athletic Director Mike Hamilton, because he's certainly not that well known. His coaching record isn't all that great. He's coming from the WAC, where he was the athletic director and head coach at Louisiana Tech. And he's kind of a bit of a mystery, but he studied under and worked under Nick Saban, Alabama's national championship winning coach, for several years. He also worked in the NFL with the Miami Dolphins. He knows the SEC. His father is Vince Dooley, the legendary coach from Georgia. There's some uncertainty, but still a lot of excitement, because Mike Hamilton interviewed some very big names. Not all of them were interested, but this was a guy who was reportedly in the mix from the start.
Austin, we should mention, because this is Tennessee, you know, no matter how badly things go for Coach Dooley and the reconstituted football program, what the heck, you still got Pat Summitt and the women's basketball team down there.
Well, and Bruce Pearl's got the number 9 ranked team in the country right now, fresh off of a home win over number 1 and previously unbeaten Kansas. So that's been the interesting dynamic. For so long, Tennessee has been a powerhouse football program. Basketball was an afterthought. Women's basketball was maybe more popular than men's basketball because of Pat Summitt and her tremendous success and national championship after national championship. That's not the case. I think all three programs can somewhat generate the same level of interest. And at this point, both basketball programs are competing at a higher level than the football program. People around here aren't used to that.
Austin Ward covers the Tennessee football program for the Knoxville News Sentinel. Austin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
It's been more than half a decade since the 2004 tsunami swept through the Indian Ocean, killing about 230,000 people in 14 countries. In many of the affected areas, there's still a dire need for food, shelter, and other necessities. Aceh Province has received an estimated $7 billion of relief, but one small Indonesian village that was all but destroyed in 2004 is attempting to take matters into its own hands by rebuilding some long fairways and a set of greens. Chad Bouchard has our story.
Dressed in a canary yellow polo shirt, Indonesian trucking mogul Dedi Sukur whacks a long drive into what appears to be an abandoned lot. The ball lands near construction debris in a patch of pine trees. Not far from the tee, a handful of cows graze on the fairway. Boulders of bleached coral are strewn here and there. Palm tree trunks rise out of the landscape and stop, their tops snapped off like broken matchsticks. But this is no backyard driving range. This is the Sulawesi Golf Course in Indonesia's Aceh Province.
I've been so bad today.
Yeah, not so good. Some of the problem is the condition of the course, and the wind is too strong. Maybe better for surfing.
Anginnya juga terlalu kencang. Mungkin untuk surfing bagus.
Dedi follows his caddy, Saddam Shamsur, into the rough to find his ball. It turns up next to an old foundation block. Lucky for Dedi, house rules allow players to move their ball within a one-club radius to get clear of the extra hazards. Saddam says playing on this course takes patience and a forgiving disposition.
You can't really push. You have to stay calm and just play.
Dedi may not be having a good day, but this is still his favorite spot to play golf. Squeezed between a horseshoe of jungle-topped mountains and pristine beaches, the course features stunning views. Sulawesi may be in rough shape now, but once it was an 18-hole oasis that attracted jet-setters and professional talent from all over Asia. The greens were immaculate, and every hole boasted a small shelter where golfers could rest in the shade. That all changed instantly on December 26, 2004, when a 100-foot-high wall of water slammed into the coast of Aceh. Caddy Mohammed Jamal remembers how the tsunami left behind a wasteland strewn with debris, sand, and hundreds of bodies.
Everything was destroyed. Before, the facilities were nice, every hole had a shelter. Now, you can't even tell.
The tsunami wiped whole villages off the map. It killed 160,000 people in Aceh province alone. The population here in Lokna village dropped from 15,000 to about 400. When it lost the golf course, the village lost a major source of income. Sulawesi had supported scores of greenskeepers, parking attendants, small food vendors, and waiters, as well as about 200 full-time caddies like Jamal and Saddam. At a makeshift caddy shack at the edge of the course, a couple dozen caddies play a game of dominoes and wait for players. Greenskeeper Jamil says restoring the course at first seemed like an impossible task.
We went to the golf course and looked at the ruins. It seemed like it could never be fixed because there was a lot of debris, a lot of fallen trees. We wondered, how are we going to fix it? We have to fix it. We have to bring it back. Then we made a plan to clean it up.
Over the last couple of years, the caddies have worked by hand, clearing away the wreckage of boats, houses, fishing nets, furniture, and other items carried here by the tsunami. They've managed to create 9 playable holes with crude miniature greens. Some of the players have come back, mostly out of loyalty. Jamil is now the head of the pool of about 50 remaining caddies who are only able to get part-time work on the course. He says the course is simply too important to give up.
It's responsible for so much of what I have. Family, children, school, my house. I built my house with money from this golf course. It means everything.
Many of these caddies started hanging around the golf course nearly as soon as they could walk. I talk with Saddam at his home over Achenese coffee served in port glasses and strong enough to curl your hair. His house is one of scores of concrete clones built here after the tsunami with aid from Saudi Arabia. He recalls collecting golf balls on the course when he was a kid and selling them to players for $1 per pack of 4.
Then one day, one of the caddies quit because one of his players was a little stingy, so I got hired. He went professional and I was his full-time caddy. I lived at his house.
Those glory days are over now. He says after the tsunami, times were desperate. Work was nearly impossible to find in the aftermath.
I bought a motorcycle pedicab to haul stuff like wood and cement. I worked like that for a while. When I would make a little money, I'd give it to my wife. But then I got sick and sold it.
The course isn't anywhere near where it used to be, and neither is his income. Still, Saddam says his 3-year-old son is likely to take up the family profession.
It's up to him, but if the father is a caddy, the son becomes a caddy too, right? He already plays golf with sticks in the yard.
By the time his son grows up, he hopes Sulawa will be a fully functional 18-hole course again, drawing pro golfers and wealthy hobbyists as a stop on the Asian tour. Back out on the course, the wind has picked up and most players have gone for the day. A few caddies play a quick round. They pause for a snack between holes at a small fruit stand on the course that overlooks the ocean. Vendor Reti Marina chops open a fresh coconut with a machete. The mother of 5 says she makes about $5 a day, a little more on weekends when the course is busiest. One of her children works as a caddy.
Caddies have a good future. They get to know important people like police or public servants and often get jobs through those connections. Many caddies become successful.
But Rina's dreams for herself are more humble. She says she just wants more players to come back so she can make a good living again. For Only a Game, I'm Chad Bouchard.
To view Chad Bouchard's photos of the Sulawa Golf Course, visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Mark McGuire's confession on Monday has provoked in various skeptics, ne'er-do-wells, malcontents, and weasels a perverse doubt regarding his veracity, his motives, and his general standing as an excellent fellow. Have those accusing Mr. McGuire of self-serving half-truths, cloudy obfuscation, and crocodile tears forgotten that without the heroic efforts of Mr. McGuire and his sidekick in splendid slugging Mr. Sammy Sosa, there would be no baseball today? In the spring of 1998, rumors swirled through the once-big, then-shriveled leagues of franchises available at fire-sale prices and stadia that would fall prey to speculators in malls, housing projects, and arms warehouses. Who could deny that football was America's game, that the fans were tired of baseball's interminable squabbles, strikes, and lockouts? Who could fail to see that a sport so magnificently self-destructive that its owners and players could scuttle a season and sink the game's own centerpiece, the World Series, was doomed? Surely soon the winds would howl through rattling grandstands in dark, empty ballparks from Los Angeles to San Diego. But no, it was McGuire and his 70 home runs to the rescue. Throughout the summer of 98, he and Sammy Sosa matched dingers prodigiously enough to leave Babe Ruth and Roger Maris in the dirt of baseball past. Shrugging off the possibility that their heads might explode, they did what we count on our athletes to do. They bore our dreams to heights previously unimaginable. With each day's clouts, they expanded their possibilities and our own. So, split me no hairs regarding what fueled the more reticent of the Bash brothers. Whatever he ingested or injected, he did it to serve us and save our game. Like Babe Ruth, who rescued baseball from the muck of the Black Sox scandal. Like Joe DiMaggio, who brought the game to people who hadn't known a curveball from a cantaloupe because they all woke up each morning wanting to know if his hitting streak was still alive. Mark McGuire helped rescue baseball from its shabbiest self. So he had to get juiced and jacked to do it. Well, so he waited a decade or so to acknowledge, at least partially, his chemical choices. What's all that against his rescue of a game we'd all be talking about in the past tense if it weren't by Bud for him? It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Five years ago, Ma Lin wed Zhang Yi, unless he didn't. I thought without a wedding banquet, the registration alone did not mean a formal marriage, Ma Lin said recently. Few people would care about this if Ma Lin, who has won 3 Olympic medals in table tennis, had not been playing poorly of late. Last week, he was knocked out of a pro tour tournament in the first round, and his coach has said that if Ma Lin does not divorce his wife soon, the former champion's career will be in danger. With a domestic problem, even the greatest athlete, like Tiger Woods, had no other choice but taking an indefinite break from playing, Ma's coach said.
Have a nice rest of your life without me. I'll be proud to be a part of your history.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Olympic basketball from its days in the primordial slime, or at least in the mud. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Monday, Mark McGuire acknowledged that he had used steroids. Holy cow, McGuire, steroids? What's next? Pro wrestling's not on the level?
I was scarcely able to get out of bed for the rest of the week for my childlike disillusion, Bill, as you know.
The children.
Oh, man. Yeah, okay, fine. Now he can get a job being a hitting coach in St. Louis, and his vote in next year's Hall of Fame election will probably manage to nudge itself above 30%. But I've got a plan, though. Let's assume for a moment that we don't catch everybody from this era.
Uh-huh.
If he hangs around long enough and he's alive when he's 70, there's going to be at least 2 or 3 juicers on the Veterans Committee. Hang in there, Mark.
Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig said that he agonized over his statement regarding Mark McGwire's admission. He rewrote that statement, quote, about 100 times while he was watching the Packers-Cardinals game on Sunday. Do you watch TV a lot when you're writing?
When I'm agonizing over the worst scandal in the history of my league, which plays baseball, I certainly think the first thing I would be doing would be watching a football game.
Major League Baseball also announced this week that it will donate $1 million to the Haitian relief effort. Any of the other sports leagues chipping in?
Yeah, the National Hockey League. Lance Armstrong will do so. This is the kind of thing that that generally folks gather around. And Gisele Bündchen wrote a $1.5 million
Mrs. Tom
check.
Brady.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And good for her.
When Lane Kiffin was hired at Tennessee 14 months ago, he said that he'd come to build a great program. So I guess that as of this week, the Tennessee program must be great.
No, he came there to build a great program at the University of Southern California.
Oh.
He didn't tell them that.
He got off the train at the wrong stop or something.
Good old
anyway,
sucker top.
There were
sucker top Tennessee. Yeehaw! This guy, I'll tell you what. He's not there 10 minutes before he's accusing Urban Meyer in Florida of cheating, thereby throwing the entire schedule up for grabs. And now he's gone.
Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll confirmed on Monday that he's off to coach the Seattle Seahawks of the National Football League. He denied that his departure from USC, where he had been the head coach since 2000, had anything to do with the various investigations of violations there.
Of course not.
I shouldn't be giggling. Anyway, so can we add him to the cavalcade of upstanding college football coaches, right, left, and center?
Yeah, I think anybody who believes that believes that Mark McGwire, took steroids because he wasn't feeling well or whatever the current
had nothing
current
to do with home runs.
Lie du jour is. Hmm. But all I can do is advise the fans of the Seattle Seahawks to throw themselves into Puget Sound right now and avoid the rush 2 years from now when they're 6-10 and Pete doesn't understand how that came about.
Joel Miller, the University of South Florida football player who had tried to cover up the fact that his coach, Jim Leavitt, had slugged him a couple of times, said this week that the assault did in fact occur and Mr. Miller wants the coach to apologize. How likely is that?
Well, if the coach is smart, he'll apologize. You know why? Because otherwise he's going to get sued and this is going to go on and on. Now, I don't know how credible Mr. Miller would be in a court, but if I were Coach Leavitt and I could get out of this by saying, look, I apologize, then I would do that.
It's divisional series weekend for the National Football League. Who do you like?
I really don't like the Baltimore Ravens, who I think are going to get lit up like a month-old Christmas tree against the Colts. I think the Cowboys are probably the best team in the league right now. And I think the Jets might have a chance to steal one out in San Diego because I do not trust the Chargers in a playoff game.
Of course, this from a man who said last week that he liked the Eagles.
I love the Eagles. I still like the Eagles. We're very close.
The Supreme Court will soon decide.
Go ahead.
The Supreme Court will soon decide whether the National Football League is one business or a collection of 32 competing firms. This is a result of an apparel company, American Needle Inc.'s antitrust suit against the league and against Reebok. To what extent is this decision, when it comes, likely to change the way the National Football League and various other leagues do business?
Well, I think if it doesn't get the antitrust protection, if the Supreme Court declares definitively that it cannot have the same antitrust protection that, say, Major League Baseball has, I think you'll find that the same thing will happen to the NHL, NASCAR, and the NCAA, and you will enter an entirely new era of how these folks do business.
There was some good news for advertisers this week. Yes, for only the second time since the Super Bowl began, the price for an ad that will run during the Super Bowl has fallen. Early this week, 62 commercial slots were still available. So you got a lawnmower or something you want to get
actually,
rid of?
Actually, no, there are smaller companies jumping in, Diamond Food and something called Dr. Pepper Snapple, which I don't think I would drink.
This is what happens in hard times is companies...
They merge? They merge, do that? Well, I'm looking forward to Smirnoff Kool-Aid myself.
I'm not. The 2009 number one NBA draft pick, Blake Griffin, was expected to help the lowly Los Angeles Clippers reverse decades of bad fortune and bad decision-making as well, but Griffin injured his knee in the team's final preseason game back in October. He's re-injured himself. He's out for the season without having played a single game. So what's next for the Clippers?
I don't know. They'll draft some really, 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 really good player in this year's draft, maybe John Wall of Kentucky, and then sometime during next preseason he'll lose an arm or something. If you're talking about a team with a black cloud following it, it is the Los Angeles Clippers, and nobody's close.
Speaking of number one draft picks, are you shocked to learn that the 2002-2003 Cleveland Cavaliers may have tanked in order to get that number one draft pick with which they acquired LeBron James?
Well, no, I'm not shocked to see it. I'm shocked that the people who owned the Cavaliers at the time are trying to deny this. They tried it. They traded half the damn roster away mm-hmm. that year. The guy was from Columbus. He's virtually saved that franchise, let alone become probably one of the two most recognizable faces of the sport. If they didn't tank that season to get him, they should have had their franchise stripped.
And finally, Charlie, this week, President Obama told an interviewer from People magazine that he thought Tiger Woods, quote, absolutely could be rehabilitated. I think that would be a waste of the chief executive's time, so I propose the president focus instead on a more important matter, and that's Boise State football. What do you think?
Yes, people are saying Boise State was undefeated and, believe it or not, should be invited to the White House, and I agree with them. And you know why I agree with them? I agree with them because it's fair and because I don't want to talk about Tiger Woods' sex life anymore.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time for a discussion of Tiger Woods' sex life.
No!
Thanks, Charlie. To view our numerous photo galleries or listen to a show or story you may have missed, please visit onlyagame.org. Men's basketball, featuring such NBA stars as Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and Dwayne Wade playing for the U.S. team, and Manu Ginobili, Dirk Nowitzki, and Yao Ming suiting up for their opponents, has become a centerpiece of the Summer Olympics. But it was not always thus. In the first manifestation of basketball at the Olympics, the fans got wet watching players slog through the mud. In American Hoops, subtitled U.S. Men's Olympic Basketball from Berlin to Beijing, Carson Cunningham has provided a history of the attraction, and he joins me now from WBEZ in Chicago. Mr. Cunningham, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, sir.
Let's begin with a description of men's basketball as it was played in the 1936 Olympics, the first time it was included in the Games. To what extent would that competition be recognizable as basketball to fans of the current game?
Oh, basically not at all. I mean, no 3 seconds in the rule, no 10 seconds to get ball across half court, a lopsided, massive ball that looked a lot more like a big soccer ball than a basketball. But, you know, most shockingly, it was outdoors, and it was on a kind of clay and dirt court that obviously if rain came down, there's going to be issues. And so, you know, the Nazis had never really embraced competitive English-styled sports, and they certainly were at first reluctant to host the games, but then they saw it as a propaganda opportunity. So the gold medal game occurred in the downpour. There was scrums for the ball. It looked kind of like a rugby match, and the U.S. won 19-8 over Canada.
In the earliest days of Olympic basketball, the governing body of the sport considered a resolution that would have banned players taller than 5 feet 8 inches. Why?
Oh, man, yeah. So the U.S. players get off the ship there, and they're sized up. And all of a sudden, a bunch of the basketball brass in the other countries decide we're in for a world of hurt here. They have Willard Schmidt and Fortenberry. These guys are 6'8". And Fortenberry and Schmidt kind of really were the first to popularize the dunk. They did it that season, and they did it during the Olympic trials in Madison Square Garden. And Arthur Daly wrote about it, and he said it's kind of like dunking your donut into your cup of coffee. And so there you get the dunk, and they just thought, what in the world are we going to do? Well, maybe we can just change the rules. Ultimately, the U.S. fought it. It didn't get passed. But this was tried again and again. It was tried as late as, I think, 1960.
You refer to the basketball competition at the Helsinki Games in 1952 as the opening salvo in Cold War basketball. How did it come to pass that basketball became a weapon in the Cold War?
Initially, both the Nazis and the communists really eschewed competitive-based sports that pitted individuals against each other or teams in ultra-competitive environments. They celebrated the Turner athletic model from German history that was more into calisthenics and kind of group aerobics and things like that, because that dovetailed more nicely with the socialist ethos. So their decision was basically based on the fact that sports were undeniably popular. I mean, the Olympics were extremely popular. So they decided, look, we got to play in the Olympics, and we got to try to show that we can dominate in the Olympics and celebrate our way of life, even if the international sporting community complements a liberal capitalist model, and even if the Olympic movement was heavily directed by European leaders who favored the type of openness and individual rights that the Soviets didn't embrace.
You write that during the 50s, the authorities in the Soviet Union, quote, conducted a virtual nationwide roundup of tall teenagers. There's a great visual image there, but how did that work out for them?
Well, they were able to find a slew of Soviet Gullivers, as some historians have called them, Race Octave, who didn't end up playing in the Olympics, but was 7'6", 404 pounds. I mean, it was unbelievable. But the guy who ended up becoming kind of the standout big man in the 50s and 60s was Ivan Krumich, the breadwinner of Soviet basketball, as he became known. He was a lumberjack who they found in the forests of, I believe it was Latvia, turned him into a basketball player. He's like the Abe Lincoln of Olympic Soviet basketball, you know, the former woodchopper turned hooper. So they had several guys near or above 7 feet throughout the 50s and 60s. But in the meantime, a guy named Bill Russell was changing really the model of the big man, showing that speed and dexterity and the ability to block shots could change the game. And they had no answer for his size, certainly at the 1956 games. And then FIBA, tiring of all the Americans who dominated in the lane, decided to implement for 1960 the trapezoid lane. And that was basically a way to say, let's get these Americans away from the basket. Coincidentally, then, you get a lot of versatile big Europeans, like nowadays Dirk Nowitzki, before that Arvydas Sabonis.
Perhaps the most dramatic Cold War episode involving basketball occurred in the gold medal game of the 1972 games when, at least according to U.S. fans, the officials gave the Soviet team three chances to score the winning basket, breaking various rules along the way. The U.S. had won the previous seven gold medals in basketball. To what extent did the loss change everything regarding basketball at the Olympics?
Well, first, if you try to approach that game from kind of a scholarly, neutral perspective, it's probably hard because I'm an American, but I tried to do that, and I really looked at the game, and one thing was clear after reading about it and having watched it, something weird was going on. I mean, there's no denying that. The head of what amounts to Olympic basketball, FIBA, R. William Jones, he eventually comes down onto the court and basically demands that 3 seconds be put on the clock. That would be the equivalent today of, like, David Stern, the NBA commissioner, going to an NBA Finals, seventh game, and then walking onto the court and saying, listen, this is how this call should be made. So it was weird. Weird, weird, weird. You know, obviously the U.S. basically got robbed. But regardless of that, the Soviets were right there with them. I mean, the level of play in Europe had improved dramatically. Also, the Soviets were wearing Adidas shoes during this game. Their players were reprimanded in the ensuing months because at international competitions they were making all these custom violations and bringing in a bunch of Western goods and trying to basically get all these extra perks through the communist system for being basketball stars. I mean, this is not what Marx envisioned, certainly.
Men's Olympic basketball now features lots of NBA players, of course, and many of those players, whether playing for the U.S. or for other countries, take advantage of lucrative international endorsement opportunities. To what extent has basketball at the Olympics become a corporate event, even beyond the extent to which that designation applies to the Olympics as a whole?
Oh, I mean, it's a tremendous commercial opportunity, and even the players don't deny that. The marketing and advertising campaigns that were launched on behalf of LeBron James and Dwayne Wade by Coca-Cola, Gatorade, respectively, starting at the 2006 World Championships in Japan and then on to Beijing in 2008, were massive. I mean, some of the biggest marketing advertising campaigns of all time. You can see the types of cultural attitudes that I'm talking about when you just look at the taglines. Li Ning is a popular Chinese shoe that's trying to basically – mimic Nike and the other leaders in the industry. And they signed Shaquille O'Neal in 2007 and then Damon Jones later. And their tagline was, forge yourself. You know, that's like individual empowerment. Yao Ming had one, Reebok launched in like 04, 05, one of the biggest marketing campaigns for a shoe company of all time with I am what I am is the tagline. And, of course, just do it.
Hey, wait a minute. That was Popeye back when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe there's some intellectual infringement there, some property infringement.
Carson Cunningham is the author of American Hoops, U.S. Men's Olympic Basketball from Berlin to Beijing, published by University of Nebraska Press. And he joined me from WBEZ in Chicago. Carson, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Yes, I appreciate you having me on. Take care.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Mary Gaffney at WBEZ in Chicago and from the world-renowned author of the Greek-Indonesian Dictionary, Peter Lydotis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Yahoo Sports Dan Wetzel, who comments on the logo of the Arizona Cardinals, a rather fierce-looking avian fellow.
Look, if your home is Glendale, Arizona, you got to do something to intimidate. They made an angry bird. You steal a bird's worm, look out.
Okay, I get it. So Cardinals by about 11. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.